Everyone, Luke here with another bonus interview for you, and this is one I'm especially delighted to share. It's not just a conversation I hope you'll find interesting and informative. It also happens to be one with a professor of economics who is a dues-paying member of Michael and Us Nation. So look, at one time or another, you've probably been in an argument, perhaps online, perhaps at home during one of those mythical Thanksgiving arguments people have with their conservative relations. Perhaps you've gotten an angry DM from someone with a guy in a powdered wig as his avatar who identifies rather stubbornly as a classical liberal. Anyways, you've been in one of those arguments and they've hit you with a barb to the effect of, you simply don't understand basic economics or something like that. So this interview is sort of a short history of how irritating nonsense like that was invented, how it was spread, and more specifically, why it's so dominant in popular language and discourse today. More seriously, this conversation is about exactly how conservative economics, so the economic ideas we now broadly think of as undergirding neoliberalism, how they essentially conquered the economics profession and later democratic politics. It's a fascinating story. It's a dispiriting story. It's a story of how a small group of once heterodox thinkers and pseudo-intellectuals languishing on the fringes at places like the University of Chicago in the 1930s, how they grew from a small intellectual sect who opposed the New Deal into a force whose ideas really helped animate and power the right-wing counter-revolution against social democracy and the welfare state in the 1970s, 80s, and 90s, the effects of which, of course, we're still living with today. So my guest is Professor Marshall Steinbaum. We talked about all of this and more. It was, for me, a really enjoyable and fascinating discussion, and I hope you dig it. So, Marshall, thank you for speaking to us. You know, when the discipline of economics is invoked today, kind of in common parlance, it almost invariably refers to neoliberal economics. I think it's safe to say the two are practically synonymous in some ways, but that wasn't always the case. And at one time, the ideas we now just think of as economics, they were actually pretty marginal. So I want to begin, you know, with your own alma mater, the University of Chicago Economics Department. During the New Deal era, you know, it's fair to say U Chicago became a kind of gathering place for thinking that went strongly against the grain of the emerging public policy consensus, and key figures in what would later become the post-war Chicago school studied there. So what did the intellectual terrain look like in the early 1930s at U Chicago in the economics department? And why specifically did it become the locus for what was at the time anyway, a fairly heterodox type of conservative economic thinking? Why at that moment?
Yeah, I think the University of Chicago Economics Department had basically been a right-wing department within American economics departments for decades before that. The University of Chicago was founded in the 1890s, endowed by John D. Rockefeller. At the time, there was the sort of new exciting thing in American economics. I mean, I guess the entire discipline was new and exciting, but the new exciting thing was researchers who'd come over from research universities in Germany where they'd been trained, Americans who'd gone to Germany for doctoral training, which was then a new concept and not present in the American higher education, came back to the United States and opened the sort of groundbreaking departments of the various social sciences. It was sort of a proto-social science era where you had people like Woodrow Wilson, as a later became known as a political scientist, Frederick Jackson Turner, who's known as a historian, trained in the first of these universities, Johns Hopkins, under Richard Eli, who was later known as an economist, or I guess you could say he was a political economist at that time. He himself was trained in Heidelberg, and I think spent some time elsewhere in Germany. He came back, went to Johns Hopkins, was known as a sort of groundbreaking researcher and teacher there, including having those two individuals as his students, and then was recruited to the University of Chicago kind of nascently, you might say, with the idea of founding the economics department in this new university that was itself kind of taking inspiration from Johns Hopkins, which was taking inspiration from these German research universities. And ultimately, the first president of the University of Chicago decided not to hire Eli and instead hired an orthodox political economist from the Harvard Economics Department or Political Economy Department. And from that moment on, the department at Chicago was definitely, basically the schema in American higher education of economics departments was you had Harvard and Yale were conservative, and then you had like Johns Hopkins, Cornell, Columbia, and Wisconsin were the progressive ones. And Chicago was this new university that overall as a university was like the progressive newer universities, but chose to ideologically align its economics department with Harvard and Yale and be the more classical in those days and what was then becoming known as neoclassical. So the leading figures of the Chicago department between the 1890s and the early 1930s were for the most part people known as being conservatives. The two that I would mention are Frank Knight and Jacob Viner. And Knight is well known among economists now because he articulated the view that economists should have nothing to do with public policy, that that was like sullying the scholarly purity of the research endeavor. And I think one, you know, given that obviously the field has not really followed Knight's advice ex post, you know, the thing that's missing from that, from the way contemporary economists would understand that directive coming from Knight, is that what he was saying was talking down the contributions of economists from other departments to the New Deal. So if you divide the economics profession into classical or neoclassical on the one hand, and as it became institutionalist on the other, so that's the word that we use to refer to economists who did not subscribe to the Harvard, Yale, Cambridge, England consensus and imported the methods of empirical investigation from the German historical school, those institutionalist scholars were more connected to the policymaking world, especially. So in the progressive era, when all of this was getting started, I would say that you had economists from of all ideological stripes involved in policy to one degree or another. I guess kind of by the 1930s, this idea that economics should be first and foremost directed towards understanding the economy for the purpose of improving it by changing policies, that had kind of become a progressive credo as the institutionalists gained more, I would say, predominant control over the discipline. I mean, it was at no time did they have total control. As I said, Chicago existed throughout and had these neoclassical figures there. But from the perspective of the 1930s, Knight saying economists should have no effect on or no influence over policy because that sullies the academic endeavor, that was his way of kind of shooting a barb at the people who were at that time dominant in the discipline and where he and his coterie would have felt to be in the minority. And they were sort of saying, well, yes, we're the minority, but we're the more scholarly. We're the ones who don't have our ideas predicated on this attempt to influence power.
So the New Deal, at least as the prevailing consensus among conservative economists understood at the time, you know, they considered it an existential threat to free market capitalism, or at the very least, a major crisis for their way of thinking, you know, representing the first stage in a kind of ineluctable march towards totalizing state control. What exactly was the analysis that these figures offered of the New Deal? What was the substance of the economic alternative they championed? What were the core ideas at play here?
Yeah, I think it's important to understand that dichotomy is not entirely static because they changed their views as the New Deal changed in very important respects. But basically, they viewed themselves as the inheritors of the 19th century consensus of what I would say is the 19th century liberalism, which is that the free market operates best when left to itself, and therefore the state should have no impact on affecting the distribution of wealth and power, what was called, at least in the 19th century, class legislation. They viewed themselves as opposed to that, whatever that happened to be. And so because what goes under the category of class legislation changed over time between the 1870s, certainly in the mid-30s, the sort of below that headline basic opposition to anything that they thought would go against the classical consensus from the 19th century, their stance about it and interpretations of it changed. It is basically more or less what we understand as Adam Smith's invisible hand. That is the thing they were trying to uphold and that they viewed the New Deal as threatening. So they thought that an economy that had independent entrepreneurs competing with each other was a more efficient economy than one that had the state directing the allocation of resources and the productive capacities of factors of production. And they certainly, you know, would have seen the latter in, like, say, the Soviet Union, especially after the 1920s, and the threat of it as arising. So, you referred to something that I associate with Hayek and an argument that only appeared in the 40s, which is that like the welfare state leads inexorably to totalitarian communism. You definitely get that in the 30s, though not expressed in that kind of stark way until the 40s. But things like so this is why I would say that there's not, there's important variation in what their stance was, even within the period we're describing. You know, as a result of the Depression, there was kind of this shift and acknowledgement that like something had failed about free market capitalism, and they couldn't just say the same things they'd been saying since the 1870s in the 1930s. But what they tried to like cling on to was this idea that there's a role for the free market and the individual entrepreneurship being the locus of decision making for the allocation of resources versus the state. And they endorse, like, from that perspective, they endorse certain aspects of the New Deal that they viewed as in service to that, and opposed aspects that they viewed as going against that. And so that, for example, led them to be in favor of antitrust enforcement in the 1930s, because they viewed that as like, kind of preserving the free market, I guess, in a very, I would say, naive interpretation of what antitrust is about. Interestingly, those very same people had opposed antitrust policy when it was at the center of progressive agenda setting in the 1900s, 1910s. They viewed that as interference with big business, which is basically how their intellectual descendants view antitrust policy now. But in the 30s, they were like, oh, this is actually the free market. Like, we want to split up these monopolies. The problem with the New Deal is actually that it's empowering over powerful corporations to act as government and command and control, and not leaving a place for competition. And again, and then they abandoned that view when the New Deal switched its view on antitrust. So in the late 30s, the Roosevelt administration, having been relatively laissez-faire on the subject of enforcing the antitrust laws, adopted them, like took them up and used them much more aggressively than had ever been done before. And that's basically what gave rise to the Chicago School, specifically at antitrust in the post-war period.
Oh yeah, let's talk about the post-war period. There's a little more history I think I want to go over, a little more kind of basic ground clearing before we get a little more into the ideas themselves. So, in the decades following the Second World War, right-wing economics, broadly defined, gradually gained steam, but they continued to remain, somewhat marginal. So how did streams like the Chicago School fare in the 1940s and 50s? And maybe you can talk a little bit about the Mont Pelerin Society as well, and how that became a gathering place for a lot of this stuff.
We definitely want to get into the sort of institution building that these individuals engaged in and ultimately led to enormous success on their part. And there's been great scholarship on that, investigating that, including not, so there's a sort of fairy tale of it that they like to tell about themselves. And then there's what I would consider to be a more accurate history of it that's told by, actual intellectual historians and historians of the post-war conservatism and so on. I do want to say one thing, that whether you take a celebratory versus skeptical line on that, it does tell a positive story of basically the way you just phrased it, that conservative economics was back on its heels and discredited by the Great Depression and basically alienated by the New Deal. And then from that position of weakness grew in strength to the point that they are today, or at least were like 30 years ago, of, total dominance. We can't underestimate the extent to which destruction was crucial to that. And I think in particular, the Red Scare was a body blow to the school of economics I previously referred to as institutionalism that was highly associated with the New Deal. So I think, we talk about McCarthyism as being a kind of paranoia about communist infiltration. And I mean, to a leftist audience, it's not a major revelation to rather understand the Red Scare as a domestic political attempt to use the threat of Soviet communism and the Cold War in order to defeat an interest that had gained influence during the New Deal. And that's basically exactly what it was. So the institutionalist economists and kind of associated intellectual types were like the left of the elites who implemented the New Deal, who staffed agencies in Washington and that sort of thing, and came out of institutionalist economics. And then they are the ones who were targeted by the Truman administration's loyalty boards, again, before actually McCarthy got going in Congress, to be rooted out of the federal bureaucracy, to, in the case of universities, to lose places there. And some prominent members of them basically changed themselves ideologically exactly to protect themselves from that attack. So people who had basically been socialists in the late 30s became kind of Keynesian defense people in the late 40s and early 50s, where you could, you know, kind of make common cause with the growing military industrial complex by saying, well, actually, we should build lots of weapons to confront the Soviets because that's good for the macro economy, you know, and that basically was a sort of armor of protection against the ravages of the Red Scare. So that is, you know, a crucial element. And it wasn't just the right-wing economists who perpetrated that within the profession. I think another important aspect of this is that there was kind of a conspiracy. I mean, it sounds a little conspiracy theory-ish. So just, you know, use the word. It's different. Other factions of the economics profession collaborated with one another in rooting out the institutionalists and making that not part of the post-war economics profession. Yes, there were the people at Chicago, people who you would label as conservative. There was also, you know, defense Keynesians who likewise labeled institutionalism as less than scientific in favor of Keynes's macroeconomic theories that have a sort of mathematical representation to them. So they could say, well, you know, those people were basically glorified sociologists or glorified social workers. You know, we're the people who really understand the hard facts about how the economy operates like a machine, and we can study it like physicists. That was a very effective rhetorical tactic. And then the organization that is called, I mean, still is called the Econometric Society, was mostly European emigres who had been active at European universities in the 30s and emigrated to the United States in the 40s. They had a kind of it's less definable in terms of ideology, but definitely a non-institutionalist, somewhat mathematically represented methodology. And so like all of those factions kind of mutually decided that institutionalism was not a scientific basis, and they wanted to claim the mantle of economics as a science, as like the queen of the social sciences and the most rigorous, which is to say least left-wing of all the social scientists. So that meant, you know, kind of cutting off any relationship with the New Deal and the people who had put it in place, even though they were, in many cases, I mean, in lots of cases, academic economists in good standing, at least when they got started with it. You know, it was kind of like made a total break, such that the received wisdom that the field tells about itself in the post-war era is like, basically that aside from, you know, Adam Smith and David Ricardo and Alfred Marshall and like these individual luminaries kind of dotting the 18th and 19th century, economics started in 1946. That's because they want to hive off the institutionalism and say it's not part of their intellectual history of the discipline.
And what about the Montpellerin Society?
Oh, yeah.
Can you give us a little backstory there?
Yeah. So yes, to get back to the sort of constructive part of this effort, the Montpellerin Society was a collection of scholars that was, I would say broadly, they viewed themselves as classically liberal and trying to preserve elements of 19th century orthodoxy into the 20th century in the face of all of the challenges and discrediting of it that happened as a result of the upheavals of the 20th century. And so in that sense, there's an obvious reason why Knight and Viner would have affiliated. I don't know if those two individuals were themselves ever members of the Montpellerin Society, but given the way I described their own approach to the field and their own ideology in the 30s, you could see why they and their students would have had some kind of affinity for the Montpellerin Society. Basically, it was cross-disciplinary at first. It was overrepresented by economists, but it's not solely an economics thing. And there was a strong representation for European intellectuals, including from what's now called the Austrian School. I guess it was called the Austrian School there, which was like basically orthodox 19th century liberalism with some slight differences that like survived into the 20th century in Austria and Vienna and certain places until the war. Oddly, the London School of Economics kind of became a branch of Austrian economics in the 30s. And so the main kind of ideological battles in British economics in the 30s took place between Keynes at Cambridge and these sort of Austrian-style people at the London School of Economics. Quinn Slobodian's written a great book about this. There were like German and Austrians and some other assorted liberal types who came together at this resort, I guess, or hotel in Switzerland and invited their friends that they, I mean, I don't know exactly how well they all knew each other before the Montpellerin Society. Kim Phillips Fine writes about this thing called the Walter Lippmann Colloquium that happened in Paris in 1938, where a lot of these people were before the war. So one way of understanding the Montpellerin Society is kind of getting the gang back together again after the war has enabled everyone to travel again and Nazism is off the table. to sort of reestablish the links between them. I think, you know, you can tell from the early history of the Mont Pelerin Society that these, like, Chicago economists came to feel that they didn't have a ton in common with people like Mises or the philosophers from, like, various European universities who also showed up at these meetings, but they kind of dutifully continued to attend. I mean, as it exists now, my understanding is that the Mont Pelerin Society is basically American led with adherence from the right wings of various other countries, right? Like the elite intellectual right of every other country. So you've got, you know, people from Latin America and from Europe, but it has basically become the sort of intellectual stomping grounds of the intellectual descendants of the Chicago economists from the 40s.
We've been talking about all of this so far in relation to, you know, economic ideas specifically in the kind of various currents of, you know, this resurgent 19th century liberalism, but over time, at least, and you know, maybe even from the outset, what we might broadly call neoclassical economics, you know, accrued a very real political dimension. And as early as the 1960s, with figures like figures on the right, like Barry Goldwater, you start to see a kind of populist political rhetoric become more visibly associated with the ideas we've been discussing. I'm curious, how did this cross-pollination happen as you understand it? Or maybe to put it a bit differently, how was it that a somewhat esoteric style of economic thinking was synthesized into something, you know, into a language that was popular and mainstream?
Yeah, I think the short answer to that is that it was useful. And that's always what determines which ideas gain adherence in politics, is whether they can be put to a certain purpose. And in the particular way that neoclassical economics was useful is in aggregating a conservative coalition against the New Deal. So we've just been describing why the neoclassical economists disdained the New Deal. You know, it turned out that they were able to reconstitute their rhetoric and their political actions in such a way that that became a core kind of strut of the anti-New Deal conservative coalition that gradually grew in strength after the 40s, basically, or during and after the late 40s. I mentioned earlier that Knight disdained economists having any influence over policy. He was using that as a rhetorical weapon to discredit his ideological opponents within the discipline by saying, like, you're involved in politics, therefore that tarnishes your scholarship. I'm separate from politics, therefore that credits mine. You know, obviously Milton Friedman and everyone who advised the Goldwater campaign didn't share that same view, or at least didn't. If they did, they overcame whatever reluctance that gave them. I would say that was because they totally inverted it in order to serve their own intellectual purposes. So in the hands of a Milton Friedman, especially of a George Stigler, this idea that neoclassical economists have influence over policy became a way of crediting their scholarship, not discrediting it. So you get, like, in Stigler's presidential address to the American Economic Association, he's like, well, our views are gaining political influence. This pendulum is swinging in our direction. That's how you know we're a science, because we're so useful to political actors that they can kind of put our ideas into motion. And I think, you know, there's an obvious reason why right-wing economic scholarship is useful to political actors, is because it is essentially a validation of the idea that the existing distribution of wealth and power is just and efficient. And obviously politicians who serve capitalist interests want to hear that. And so if this is like, oh, well, you know, we're not just flagrant, like, stooges of capital, like, we actually have this sort of pretext of a scholarly and, like, sensible and internally consistent theory of how the world works, and, like, we're putting that into motion, and, like, if that happens to have an egalitarian effects, well, too bad, because we have to serve these other aims, like economic efficiency. I think another way of understanding this on, like, a sociological or political sociological level is that, you know, as you characterized Friedman's use of neoclassical economics in the Goldwater campaign as populist, and I think that's absolutely right in a way that bears some examination. So if you imagine the sort of New Deal consensus and the corporate state that emerged from it, of, like, managerial corporatism and bureaucrats in Washington having a lot of power and entrepreneurs not having as much power as they did in the 20s or whatever, or big business, you know, Friedman would phrase his, say, opposition to the minimum wage as being in itself egalitarian, because he would say, well, you know, the minimum wage kills jobs, so it's actually bad for the people that it's trying to help. So, like, I agree with your goal of making the economy more egalitarian, but just the method that you're saying to do that will have the opposite effect, because it's going to disemploy a lot of people. So they'll go from earning a wage that's less than the minimum wage to a wage of zero. So it's actually not in their interest. So he was good at, like, inverting the kind of criteria of policy evaluation. And then I think at the same time, whole questions about distribution were sort of steadily swept under the rug within the field. So we had, Thomas Piketty writes a great deal about this, given that he's like pretty well revived the study of inequality within economics. Simon Kuznets, who was another president of the American Economic Association, gave a speech at his presidential address in the early 50s that was like, inequality used to be high, now it's low. There's an inevitable process of capitalist development that leads to egalitarian outcomes. That's where we are. So we don't have to worry about inequality anymore, because all an economy has to do is develop to the point of where we are now, and inequality will inevitably go away. And so that justifies basically not paying attention to it anymore, not gathering any statistics about it, not enacting policies that are egalitarian and repealing those that are egalitarian, because the idea is, well, if equality is inevitable, we don't need a progressive tax, for example, to make the economy operate more equitably. And again, that's not from conservative branch of the economics field. That's like from the rest of the economics field, essentially sort of adopting more or less, out of whole cloth, the ideology that guided this very specific set of, quite ideologically motivated colleagues.
So something the populist right has done very effectively, I mean, the populist right, the political version of it that I just referred to, but also, the more academically oriented and economics oriented version of it, something they've done very effectively is to capture the broad idea of individual freedom, right? So when the market rules, people are free and relations are voluntary. When the welfarist functions of the state get bigger, when more regulatory structures are put in place, et cetera, that's collectivism, right? And individuals become less free. But the garnish of small d democracy that kind of rhetoric implies, I think, really obscures the overtly anti-democratic and elitist conception of society that the right's most influential economic intellectuals had from the very beginning. So can you talk a bit about this specific animus towards democracy and how that's played a role in all of this since the beginning?
Oh man, I mean, there's tons to say here.
Big question, obviously, yeah.
In order to motivate this idea that like a free market economy is free in the sense that individuals are at most autonomous in a free market, and welfarist prescriptions or however you want to characterize the New Deal reduces freedom because it makes people less autonomous in their economic activities. That requires, in my view, I think the move that's necessary to make it work is eschewing any notion of power in studying the economy. And, that means your investigations into how the economy work can't possibly be successful if you're ignoring the force that's most relevant to determining how the economy works. But that's the move that they make. So you get lots of scholarship on their part that's like, well, the notion of power is uneconomic, whatever that means. So we don't like economics as a field, as a discipline, as a methodology, doesn't study that subject and doesn't include it in its modeling of purported economic outcomes because there's something suspicious about the overall idea that can't be entertained, and like what economics consists of as a discipline is studying the economy outside, ignoring the concept of unequal power relations between actors in the economy. So that's like a through line throughout their work. And I think that's the thing that has gotten them, obviously into empirical trouble. And I think that's the thing that they're having trouble kind of covering up for now. I think, as you said, like notwithstanding Friedmanite type populistic rhetoric about individual autonomy stemming from unconstrained relations in the economic sphere, they are very deeply anti-democratic. And that is a legacy of the 19th century. So that is a direct through line of elite orthodox economics from the 1870s right to the present day, including in the 30s and 40s, where people on the right of the economics profession disdain democracy and view the exercise of democratic rights as subverting the natural economic order. So this is highly salient right now because these same people are kind of embarked on an exercise of trying to say that the progressive economists that were the predecessors of institutionalism or espoused eugenicism and the reduction of individual freedom in service to the state, whereas classical economics of the 19th century were like the true egalitarians who were actually like hashtag actually anti-racist, because they didn't think that people should be consigned to certain roles in the economy based on their background or function of the household. So like that's an elaborate way of saying that like actually allowing child labor rather than prohibiting it is egalitarian. Disdain for democracy, as I said, is a through line they just don't view the political sphere and the democratic sphere as a place where autonomy or rights are exercised or should be exercised. So at the same people who are like, oh yes, children should be free to supply their labor. Like, we can't have a free market without child labor. Like, be damned if, you know, not only is that exploitative of children, but it reduces wages for working age people. That's their notion of freedom. Their notion of freedom definitely does not include everyone voting in an election. So they were in favor of restricting the franchise, and, you know, they were in favor of executing trade unionists. I mean, all manner of things that a normal person would think definitely fall under the category of freedom, they view as threats to the social order, and therefore freedom goes out the window if, you know, if those things are the result of it. So, well, I mean, I was just going to mention this, you know, Nancy McLean's book, Democracy in Chains, about James Buchanan. You know, that's...
Yeah, that was what I was going to ask you about, in fact.
Yeah. So, you know, I think McLean absolutely convincingly argues that Buchanan is reactionary and anti-democratic in all he espoused. I think even since that book has been published and was received with extreme anger and vituperation on the part of his intellectual heirs, you know, more scholarship has come out that basically validates McLean's point of view. So, for example, she doesn't talk about his views on the Supreme Court's reapportionment decisions in the 1960s that basically mandated one person, one vote for legislative apportionment. You know, Buchanan wrote a bunch of papers that was like, well, actually, we want malapportionment, which is to say, you know, upper houses of state legislatures in the United States Senate that aren't representative of people, but rather of states or of counties or whatever, however it works at the state level. We want that because that lack of representation ensures efficient economic policies will be enacted. So it's like, okay, well, if your upper house of a legislature is the thing that's going to block income taxes because you have, you know, wealthy landowners having disproportionate say or something like that, you know, that's actually good because income taxes are bad for the economy. So it's actually efficient to have this malapportionment in the legislature. You know, that's a very strong, a shining example of the utility of neoclassical economics and broadly speaking, this entire intellectual group to conservatism. Because, like, basically what you have is the Warren Court handing down a decision that says that the way that Southern state legislatures are malapportioned is unconstitutional under the United States Constitution. And a normal person would interpret that as an expansion of freedom because poorly represented people now have equal say in voting for the legislature. So it becomes a more democratically accountable body. You know, Buchanan objects to that, but he doesn't object to that literally on the grounds of Black people shouldn't be able to vote, you know, white people should rule. He objects to it on the grounds of, oh, well, actually, that will lead to inefficient economic outcomes. So a reason to oppose this democratic representation is that, you know, it would actually be bad for the economy. And so that's exactly the useful pretext that makes this kind of thinking so well represented in the kind of broadly reactionary movement after the New Deal.
Incidentally, I reviewed that book once, and I was flooded with, you know, emails from people who, you know, had a suspicious amount of message discipline in their objections. Yep. To what I wrote. And I think, I believe when you reviewed it yourself for the Boston Review, you experienced something rather similar.
Yes. I mean, it wasn't a surprise to me. I don't know if it was not surprising to you, but I know how these people operate. And, you know, in the present day, basically you have these billionaire backers, you know, most prominent among them, Charles Koch, who have these centers and scholars seated at all these different universities. So as I said, I may have said it on Know Your Enemy podcast, you know, it seems like there's this broad rejection of the book by a swath of academics coming from all locations, but it is in fact a ruthless ideological political machine all operating off of the same talking points as you experienced. And like, they're very good at, you know, there's not just like one Sauron castle of evil that, from which this all emanates. I mean, even though there basically is that, but they're good at making it look like, you know, they have actual scholars represented at actual universities and many of them. So they're very pluralistic.
Yeah, the Sauron castle, the Barad-dûr, is just the ruling class.
Well, I mean, that is certainly true, but I would modify that by saying, like, it's not just the entire ruling class operating. Like, you know, even the Koch brothers, like, can't get all their fellow billionaires to operate in exactly as ruthless and organized a way as they want to operate. So it is a subset of the ruling class that is, like, so regimented and controlled and, like, activated on particular matters, such as the intellectual history of the economics profession, but is, you know, been so obviously decisively influential on American politics and society.
I guess I have a kind of final question here, which is maybe, you know, it's maybe a bit of a difficult one. The journey of right-wing economic ideas in the 20th century is really one, you know, from a position of near total intellectual and political marginality in the 1930s and 40s to one of, I mean, fairly astonishing hegemony I mean, in the present, but I mean, as you said before, particularly in the 1980s and the 90s, where, you know, there was this crisis of the kind of Keynesian welfare state, the kind of post-war model, the Bretton Woods system, all of this kind of fell apart. And, you know, here all these people were, as David Harvey has documented so wonderfully in his brief history of neoliberalism, here was this entire kind of school of people who said, well, we've got the solution to this. And they succeeded. So I'm curious whether you think there's anything the socialist left, either the socialist left as it's embedded in economics departments today, which I assume its presence there is pretty minimal, or just more broadly, is there anything that we can learn from the right-wing experience in the 20th century?
Yeah, I have to say, I used to feel that we had a lot to learn from that, and I have come to not believe that anymore. Not to say we can't learn anything from it. I think there are aspects of the way that they operated and organized themselves that are inherently elitist and that require a prior ideology of the wealthy and powerful should have total control over society and the economy should be organized to their benefit. That, given that the way that it's organized is so top-down and so authoritarian, like, you have to have that consonance between the ideology that they are looking to bring forward in the world and put in place and the way that the forces that put in place that ideology are themselves organized in order to make it work. You know, and I say that in part due to my own fairly negative experience dealing with the closest analog to this that exists on the left, which is a bunch of philanthropically funded think tanks designed to, like, sway the policy conversation on economics in a direction that's more at least progressive or more to the left than the orthodoxy that these people put in place. And, like, the motivation for the existence of those think tanks is, you know, convincing. I mean, you know, there's, like, even when you've got seemingly, you know, a democratic administration or whatever, that, like, they're still suffused in an ideology that of austerianism or of, you know, the fact that what the way that people are paid in the labor market is dependent on their skills and not on the imbalance of power between workers and employers. Like, you can see why they exist, but they're just not effective at doing, I mean, they're certainly not effective at doing what socialists would want them to do. Now, that's not too surprising because they're not socialist organizations, but there's also just, like, the way that the philanthropic funding model works is so top-down and exploitative of the people who are within the organization itself that, like, there's no way of having something that is, like, so fundamentally constructed on an unsound basis for implementing a left-wing plan, actually implement a left-wing plan. So I guess, you know, having seen that experience, like, what could socialists learn from the right-wing economists, you know, starting from the Chicago people in the 30s to now? I mean, I guess one piece of, like, hardening or one lesson that one could take from that is that, like, of the role of intellectuals in a political movement, disputes among intellectuals do actually matter. I mean, Keynes was right about that in his lifetime. You know, he experienced essentially the opposite of what we're talking about, which is, you know, he came up in a Cambridge in which classical economics was totally hegemonic and more or less single-handedly, I mean, that's obviously an exaggeration, but basically shifted the ideology of the economics profession, you know, decisively away from that, even though he himself was not a leftist by any stretch of the imagination, you know, and he's a brilliant man who worked his whole life to bring that about and for decades was on the outside and, you know, events came to validate his point of view and he subsequently had a great deal of influence. You know, that is basically also the model that Friedman experienced. I mean, if you ask, like, Paul Krugman, for example, why right-wing economics became so powerful, he'll tell you that the stagflation of the 1970s validated Friedman's theories about macroeconomics and invalidated Keynesian ones. I don't think that intellectual history is quite right, but it is true that, like, these ideas gained plausibility and adherence through the view that they accurately explained what happened and the ideological paradigms that policymakers had been operating under were just totally discredited. And I would say, like, the Great Recession of 2008, 2009, the financial crisis certainly had that effect. And obviously it's why we have Occupy Wall Street and the sort of upsurge of the left in the 2010s. You know, the actual organized left, the professional left, wasn't really in a good enough shape to capitalize on it the way that these right-wing people were on the stagflation crisis of the 1970s and the seeming discredit of Keynesianism. And I don't know exactly what the solution is to that because we do not have billionaires who will fund think tanks to do what those people did and were in place and ready to spring when the 70s rolled around. The places that have been funded to that end just do not serve that function.
I was born in a welfare state, ruled by bureaucracy, controlled by civil servants and people dressed in grey. hundred people took it all away.